Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
I'm Saruti.
I'm Hannah.
And welcome to the first week of October here at Red Handed.
Yeah, spooky season
has
arrived.
Hooray! So let's get into it.
Yeah.
The depravity of what you did to those you killed and those you defiled after death reveals that your conscience is seared. It is almost impossible to believe that a single man can cause the misery to so many that you have done. But you did it, and in consequence, you are paying the price that human justice can exact: the rest of your mortal life in prison.
Those dramatic but fitting words narrated for you there by the esteemed Saruti Bala were those of Mrs. Justice Chima Grubb on the 7th of December 2022, when she sentenced one of the most despicable men we've come across. Home invasions, murder, rape, paedophilia, necrophilia. He did it all. And it is very dramatic, isn't it? It's like your conscience is seared. It's almost Philip Pullman-esque, you know?
The rest of your mortal life. It's just, it's great. That's why I wanted to start with it. It's originally I had it at the very end and I was like, nah, let's push Justice Chima Grubb all the way to the top. And all this misery and terror that quote speaks of unfolded over 3 decades in the town of Royal Tunbridge Wells here in the UK.
Really good Wetherspoons in Tunbridge Wells. It used to be a cinema.
Well, there you go. It's a very affluent place, about 30 miles southeast of London. Known, I didn't know, for its Wetherspoons, but also for its world-famous gardens, fairy tale moated castles, posh high street, and romantic country manors.
Yeah, it's called the Banker Belt.
I can see that. But in December 2020, this bougie Banker Belt town was rocked by the arrest of a 66-year-old electrician. What the police found in his small, semi-detached family home on a quiet, unassuming estate was like nothing this country had ever seen before.
And you can rest assured, all you lovely listeners, that we are not, for once, being hyperbolic. Because, welcome, we are treading on sacred ground. It's October, the holiest of holy months in the red-handed calendar. So we've done what we always do, gone out of our way to find the most disturbing cases that we could dig up. And we're going to be serving you these horrible episodes over the next few weeks, and they all come with a very strict no-eating warning, this one in particular.
Now, I was shocked that I did not know this story. Firstly, because it is horrific, and secondly, because the arrest that broke the case happened just a few years ago in 2020.
I feel exactly the same. Like when you were talking about it in the office, I was like, how?
I have no idea.
How has this passed us by, gone under the radar, whatever fucking metaphor you want?
I honestly don't know. But before we get to that particular arrest in 2020 and to the man at the heart of this house filled with its hard drives from hell.
Nice.
We have to rewind all the way back to the late 80s.
On the 23rd of June 1987, the Supersnaps on Camden Road in Tunbridge Wells noticed that the manager, 25-year-old Wendy Nell, hadn't turned up for work. That wasn't like Wendy at all. She was super organised. She took her job incredibly seriously and she was never even a minute late, which is probably why she was a manager at just 25. Eventually, Wendy's colleagues managed to get in touch with her boyfriend, Ian Plass. He said that he dropped Wendy off at her bedsit at 14 Guildford Road the night before, and he hadn't heard from her since. So Ian went to Wendy's to check on her. He let himself into the ground floor flat. And we can't even imagine how he must have felt when he saw Wendy.
She was clearly dead. She had been brutalized, and her naked body had been posed on her bed. She'd been laid on her left side, with her knees slightly apart. Wendy had suffered significant blows to the head, and she'd been strangled. Authorities would later determine that she'd also been sexually assaulted. The post-mortem would discover that there was semen in her mouth, vagina, and all over the sheets. There were also signs of forced anal penetration. And all of this had been done after Wendy was already dead.
There was blood absolutely everywhere in the room, likely because Wendy's body had been moved multiple times while she was bleeding from the wounds she'd sustained to her head. The police believed that this was due to the killer moving and posing Wendy in different positions as she bled out. Because there was no sign of a fight or any mess or disturbance in the flat, and there were no defensive wounds at all to Wendy's body. So it's not like she was moving around, trying to fight back or something like that. It really looked to the police like this was a blitz attack by a killer who had either been hiding in Wendy's room, shudder, or who snuck in and then attacked her while she was asleep.
It really is like the worst nightmare, isn't it? Like when you're in bed, it's when you feel the safest, but also sometimes feel the most vulnerable. The idea of somebody hiding in your house, waiting until you fall asleep to blitz attack you. I mean, is there anything more terrifying?
No. That is why my dog sleeps in my bed.
Uh-huh.
And also because I didn't crate train her because it was very difficult.
And so, as if that wasn't all chilling enough, it was also clear that this killer wasn't some random opportunistic nutter, and it wasn't a home invasion that had gone wrong. This killer was careful and confident. And although the kill had been swift and savage, he had taken his time with Wendy, posing her body and indulging in his sick sexual fantasies. This killer had known that he wouldn't be disturbed, and it screamed of a man who had been watching Wendy and waiting. It also turned out that the killer had taken some items from Wendy's room. Her diary for that year, which was 1987, and also her keys. Clearly they were trophies, since the killer didn't need the keys to break in, as the police discovered just how easy it had been for him to gain access to Wendy's sadly run-down room. There was only one window that faced out onto a poorly lit alley, and you couldn't even close the window properly from the inside because the latch had been painted over. It's likely whoever did this already knew about the faulty window, because he had got in and out so easily. It's terrifying. It's basically like they call this area where Wendy lives bedsit land. And I don't know, I had to look up what a bedsit was, but basically I think it's just a HMO.
Yeah.
It's just a room in a HMO, so a house of multiple occupancy. So she shares the kitchen, the bathroom with everybody else, but she has her own room. And it's an end terrace Victorian property, and she's on the ground floor. And the door is at the front, and the only window into Wendy's bedroom faces out onto this alley that has no lights in it. Hate it so much.
Naturally, Wendy's family were utterly destroyed by her death. Wendy's body was actually found on her dad's birthday. He rushed over to Wendy's flat after receiving a distraught call from Ian. And one of the officers outside, not realising that he was talking to Wendy's father, told Mr. Nell, "I can't let you in. The girl inside is dead."
It just is so awful.
Wendy was very young, and she was just coming out of a really tough time. She'd left home, and she'd also got married pretty young as well, but it didn't work out, and she moved into that bedsit after her divorce. She hated it. She hated living there, and she spent as little time in the tiny room as she possibly could. But she stayed because she wanted her independence. When my mum's first marriage, which I only found out about when I was 16 and she got drunk, she got divorced, and she told me, she was like, and I just remember being in a phone box because that's where rooms to let were advertised then. And I was just crying because I had nowhere to go.
It's so sad. And Wendy could have gone back to her parents' house, but I think for her, it felt like a step backwards. Mm. She really, really hated this place, but she desperately wanted to make something of herself in her career, even if it meant starting off her new life in this horrible bedsit. She really wanted to do it for herself. And speaking of people that like find out about their parents' first marriage much later, didn't happen to me, but a friend of mine, I won't say her name, obviously, but years ago, had been at her grandmother's house and found a vase. And her grandma was like, oh, that was your mum's old vase. And she was like, oh, can I have it? And she was like, yeah. And she turned it upside down, and on the back, it was her mum's name, but with a different surname. And it wasn't her maiden name either, obviously. She was like, whose surname is that? And her grandma was like, her first husband's.
Oh my God, that's so good.
And they had a kid that she didn't know about.
Secret family.
And the kid had been adopted.
Oh my God.
I know. Because it was like really pasto, and they were like, we're not staying together. They broke up before the baby was born. So she had the baby, put the baby up for adoption, and then just got separated, wow. Got remarried, had her two new kids. And she was like, so I have a half sister out there who was just adopted. Isn't that bonkers?
That is bonkers.
Crazy.
I think my mum ended up, she moved in because she was a ward sister. And she moved into the student nurse accommodation. So she was living with students, but was head honcho.
Sure.
But she hadn't just had nowhere to go.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot.
Because there just weren't places for single women to live.
No.
Anyway, she hated the bedsit, but things were looking up for Wendy at the age of 25. She'd met Ian, and the two were planning on getting married. And Wendy just couldn't wait to be a mum. No one could understand how this horrific attack had happened to such a normal young woman on such a quiet road in such a nice town.
Police interviewed everyone. Wendy's dad, her boyfriend Ian, her ex, her sister's boyfriend. They cast the net wide, interviewing all known rapists and predators in the surrounding towns. But they had nothing. Apart from, of course, all the semen and blood prints from the scene. Remember, like we said, it was an incredibly bloody and brutal scene. There's footprints, handprints, fingerprints everywhere. But this was the 80s. And forensic science was still very much a baby with a wobbly neck. However, I do have to give the Kent and Sussex police, who were involved in this case, so much credit, all the way from 1987 up until 2021. Because the original investigators knew that while they couldn't do much with the forensic evidence, they saved it all. And they stored it properly and waited for the science to advance.
You love to see it.
Oh, they just do such fucking good work. This should be, and I'm sure it is, studied by every single police force out there, because this is how you fucking do it. They are mwah.
Meanwhile, the police did what they could do while waiting for science to science. And that meant good old-fashioned police work. As Saru said, there was a bloody shoe print that had been left on Wendy's blouse at the scene of the crime, and investigators went to every single shoe shop in the local area and managed to figure out that the print came from a very specific Clark's trainer. Clark's is for school shoes only. Who is buying trainers from Clark's?
This fucking guy. Clark's, for all of our non-UK listeners, is just like a high street shoe shop where when you were a kid, you were regularly traumatised by having to go there and have your foot measured and try on lots of different shoes.
But again, even when they figured out that it was a Clark's clodhopper, they couldn't do much with that information until the police had a suspect. But because they know what they're fucking doing, they banked it. And every little piece of evidence they saved and scraped together would pay dividends. It would just take 33 years.
So, as the weeks passed with no developments, the fear in Tunbridge Wells ramped up. Everyone had thought that the police would catch somebody, but it was looking increasingly unlikely. And people were terrified. The police even handed out rape alarms to all the women in the town, a move which only seems to have scared everyone even more. Because they also now started receiving regular complaints from single women living in bedsits around the town of a prowler peering into their windows at night and breaking into their homes while they were out.
Nope.
No. And I don't know how much of that is like because people are just scared, but it wasn't all just because of that. Because as we will see, there is a prowler about.
My first night in the house share I used to live in before I moved into my flat. So this would have been 5-6 years ago, even more than that. So my first night, my room was right at the front of the house, and it's like big Victorian terrace, bay window. And in the middle of the night, someone knocked on the window.
No.
And I was like, oh my God. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Like I told everyone that Haringey was fine and now I'm going to die. And then I went to the door and Matt was at the top of the stairs. And he was like, what are you doing? And I was like, there's someone outside. And he was like, well, don't go out there. And I was like, but what am I supposed to do? And he's like, if you're going to go, take this screwdriver.
So they can take it and stab you to death with it. No.
And it was a couple who were having some sort of argument and there was like shattered mirror on the like front bit. And they just sort of went away. But like Matt was just like, welcome.
Oh, I mean,
never happened again. It was just terrible luck. It was the first night.
Once is all I need to have a fucking heart attack in my bed.
Hey, man, I will take that over my neighbour in Poplar who had an ISIS flag in the window.
Correct.
Anyway, the police were desperate to end the panic in Tunbridge Wells, and they really tried to get a break. 4 months after the murder, the Kent police took Wendy's case national by featuring it on the British Bastion, Crime Watch, which was then the BBC's flagship crime programme. The police were after any witnesses who had information regarding a sighting of a Peeping Tom on nearby Grove Hill Road at 12:30 a.m., about an hour after Ian had dropped Wendy home. And they also wanted to know about a car, a blue or grey Talbot Horizon, which had been seen at 1:10 a.m. having difficulty starting the engine outside Wendy's house. But despite the tips, nothing really came out of this appeal.
Then, 5 months later, the killer struck again. On the 24th of November 1987, 20-year-old Caroline Pierce vanished. She had spent the day with friends and returned home to her basement flat on Grosvenor Road in Tunbridge Wells in a taxi at around 11:55 p.m. Similarly to Wendy, Caroline lived alone following a breakup with her partner Andy, and the similarities didn't end there. Caroline's house was just half a mile away from Wendy's place, and she worked at an American restaurant called Buster Brown's, also on Camden Road, just a quarter of a mile from the Supersnaps where Wendy had worked. And just like Wendy, Caroline had had a dodgy window lock. And given all the fear in the town about prowlers, she had just that week had the lock on her window fixed. Oh, and also, Wendy and Caroline, if you go and look at our social media, look at the pictures of them, they look so similar. They could have been sisters. Both of them are very young. They're very pale. They both have like quite like boyish haircuts with dark brown hair. So similar. The key difference between their cases was that Caroline was gone, missing. Neighbours reported later that they had heard screams coming from near Caroline's flat the night that she vanished. In fact, 9 sets of neighbours said they heard screaming, but nobody had called the police. And Caroline was never seen alive again.
As it usually does, suspicion immediately fell on Caroline's ex-boyfriend, Andy, despite the fact that he told police that Caroline had been convinced that someone was stalking her.
Andy and Caroline, despite the fact that they'd broken up, they were still very close. Like, she spoke to him all the time. And I've watched interviews with Andy and he's like, she would call me all the time, convinced that there was somebody outside her window.
And actually, one of these calls to Andy saying, I think there's someone outside, happened just a couple of weeks before she'd vanished. She called Andy in the middle of the night and told him to come over because she was so freaked out. But whether the police really believed that Andy was guilty, or if they were trying to avoid the panic of a serial killer running around in Tunbridge Wells, it's quite difficult to know.
Yeah, it's much better for them if it's just a disgruntled ex-boyfriend.
And most of the time it is.
Yes, yes. But if they had any thoughts of the fact that it was Andy, all of that did change on the 15th of December, when Caroline's naked body was found nearly 40 miles away from her home, on the Romney Marshes in Kent. A tractor driver had spotted her body. It had been dumped in a water dike, and she was completely naked except for a pair of tights. And the similarities to Wendy's death were now undeniable. Caroline had been beaten around the head with a blunt object, strangled and sexually assaulted. But the level of decomposition, because her body had been in water for weeks, made figuring out much more nearly impossible. But investigators did find semen on her tights.
How much of it must there have been if she's been in water and it's still there?
Yeah, I mean, they do say that the sample was severely degraded, but it's there. And that's the thing, is when Caroline first goes missing, obviously people are like, oh my God, it's linked to Wendy. But the police weren't totally convinced because she's missing. She's not been murdered in her home. It feels like a different case. But once they find her in the marshes, they kind of stop looking at Andy and realise we have got a bigger problem on our hands.
And the media ran hard with this bigger problem. The killings were linked together and they became known as the Bedsit murders. And then investigators thought that they might finally have had a break. There was a vicious rape attack on Dudley Road in Tunbridge Wells. A 34-year-old single woman living alone in a bedsit was ambushed by a man with a knife. This man, called Stuart Durkin, was caught within 24 hours and everyone thought that the nightmare was over. Durkin admitted to the rape on Dudley Road and also to 20 other burglaries, including one on Caroline's bedsit before she had moved in. So it really looked like the police had got their man. He was a prowler, he had no alibi for the night Wendy was killed, and he also had a conviction for manslaughter. But what they didn't have was hard evidence. They didn't have anything they could charge him with for Wendy's murder. So the police charged Durkin with the rape he admitted to, but when it came to the bedsit murders, they were back to square one.
People were terrified, and the authorities were desperate. But they just had so little to go on. Despite the fact that they had interviewed over 1,400 people and taken over 900 statements. There was just nothing. And eventually, the case went cold. But everything, all the evidence, like I said, was stored away carefully. And now, we're going to take a massive three-decade leap into the future, to 2008. Because this was when the Kent Police put together a cold case team who reopened the bedsit murders investigation. Some of the officers on the team who were part of this cold case investigation had just been children when the original case had unfolded. But they knew all about the infamous killings.
And bingo. Almost immediately, this new team had something. Because it's the now times and they were able to test the semen found on Wendy and compare it to the semen that had been found on Caroline's tights. And it was a match. So, this was the first time that Kent Police could definitively prove that the same man had killed both of those women. Next up, they ran the full DNA profile they secured from the crime scene at Wendy's house through the police's DNA database. Surely a man who'd killed two women would be in there for something else. But surprisingly and frustratingly, they got no hits. And so, while they now knew for sure that it was the same killer, they still had no way of finding the suspect.
It would be another 11 years before they could. So once again, the evidence was stored away. And in 2019, the new cool kid on the block entered the scene. Familial DNA testing.
Thunderclap. We've talked about this before on the show, but basically what familial DNA testing is a technique that allows investigators to identify whether someone is related to a person whose DNA is discovered at a crime scene. So now the police ran the killer's DNA through the police database again and found 1,000 potential relatives.
Kent Police worked with over 20 other police departments across the country to narrow this list down to 90. They then went to interview all these people and collect their DNA again for analysis. And they eventually found that one man had the closest partial match with the killer's DNA. And this person had a brother who matched the Bedsit killer's profile, David Fuller. Fuller lived close to Tunbridge Wells, and he was the right age, he was 63. They also discovered that he had been in trouble as a teenager for stealing bikes and starting fires. And then, in a clear red flag, Fuller was convicted in 1973 and then in 1977 for a series of creeper home burglaries, involving break-ins through rear windows. But unbelievably, he was never sentenced to jail time for these. And the reason his DNA hadn't shown up in the police's database despite these crimes was because the police in the UK didn't start collecting DNA samples from people who were arrested until 1984.
On the 3rd of December 2020, police arrived at Fuller's home in Heathfield, East Sussex, a town about 14 miles away from Tunbridge Wells. David Fuller lived there with one of his three children and his third wife. Fuller was calm as he was arrested, according to officers. He almost seemed to have been expecting them, and given that this happened in 2020, he's not fucking going anywhere, is he?
No. I mean, I've watched the full clip of him being interviewed, like the police's body cam footage. And like, I was going to include a clip here, but it's kind of pointless unless you can see his face. Mm. And he's just like, he looks like the police have popped round to be like, oh, your neighbor's complaining about your fence being too high. He's so calm. He just sits down. He's just like, okay. They're like, do you understand your rights as we've read them to you? He's like, yeah, no problem. Am I coming with you now? Okay. And I don't know, I'm not at all of the mind that all killers want to get caught. I think that's such a strange thing when people say that. But I think he was expecting it. And I think he was like, I've had my run.
Once they got him down the station, Fuller was very compliant in interviews. He was quiet and he was polite. And when his DNA was tested, it was confirmed. David Fuller was indeed their man. There was a 1 in 1 billion chance that the DNA from the crime scene at Wendy's house was not Fuller's. 1 in 1 billion.
Yeah. So when people are like, oh, the DNA matched, you can't actually say that. The best you can say is the likelihood of it not being yours is 1 in 1 billion. It's like, it's 1 in infinity, you might as well say. It's not anyone else's.
When presented with this information, though, David Fuller denied everything. He said he didn't even know Tunbridge Wells. He hadn't heard of the Bedsit murders from the 80s, and he'd never met Wendy or Caroline. Polite he may be, but he's also a bad liar. And his story was pretty swiftly disproven by the police.
They discovered that Fuller was an electrician who had worked all over Tunbridge Wells in the 80s. In fact, at the time of the murders in 1987, Fuller had just married his third wife, and they had lived together in Tunbridge Wells.
Very easy to find this information, you know?
It's just so easy. His wife was a teacher, and she had had staff accommodation at a school that was just a couple of miles away from both Wendy and Caroline's flats. And before that, Fuller had actually lived just 100 yards from Wendy's flat. Fuller also kept incredibly detailed and obsessive notes about his everyday life. And the police soon found out that he had visited both Wendy and Caroline at work. He had gone to eat at Buster Brown's, and he'd got his photos developed at the local Supersnaps. It all fit the profile of a highly organised killer who had stalked and watched his victims planning his attack.
Police even matched Fuller to the bloody fingerprints found in Wendy's room. And they discovered pictures of Fuller from the time of the killings, laying around wearing the same type of fucking Clark's trainers that had left the bloody footprint on Wendy's blouse.
It's just too good. Like, obviously, it's amazing that the police from the 80s saved all that information, found the type of trainer. And the police now, when they pick it up, the cold case team, literally find a picture of him laying in the grass at a picnic with his feet up so you can see the tread of the trainers perfectly.
I have a question.
Uh-huh.
It's very important.
Tell me.
Did the Clark's trainers have the flashy lights?
No, because he's a prowler. He put tape over them when he's prowling, takes them off when he's going bike riding, as we find out he fucking loves to do.
I saw a really funny tweet the other day that was like, I hate it when I buy new trainers and no one asks me how fast I can run in them. Being an adult's fucking shit.
Oh my God. I I'm like a recent convert to the trainer. I used to never wear them, and now it's all I live in.
That's true, actually.
Yes, I know. And now it's all I wear. But the other day, Sam was like, you should wear more comfortable trainers than the ones you wear. And I was like, these are perfectly comfortable. You should see the shoes I used to wear. And he bought me some new ones. And I'm like, oh, okay, thanks. Because I just like a good cream, plain, classic trainer. He's bought me these trainers. I put them on. I look like a nursery nurse. I'm like, I cannot wear these in public. I don't know what to do with them now. And he'll never hear this because he doesn't listen to the podcast.
I think it was your ankle injury that was the cutoff point.
Yes. And ironically, didn't hurt myself wearing heels. Fell over in bare feet after a shower while I was fucking drunk.
Another unbelievable thing the police came across was that David Fuller would regularly go cycling around Romney Marshes, which is where Caroline's body was found. Fuller even had a post-it note in his wallet with 1987, or the year of the murders, written on it. And why would he have that on a post-it note in his wallet? It was the PIN number for his card.
How old are you? He's only in his 60s. You're writing a fucking PIN number down on a post-it note in your wallet.
Stuck to the card it's for.
Jesus Christ, you're not 90. Come on.
Between all of these findings and the crucial DNA evidence from the semen, regardless of Fuller's denials, this looked very much like a slam dunk. There's a one in a billion chance of it not being a slam dunk.
Uh-huh. But if you take but a glance at the timeline left on this episode on your podcast player, you will know that this is not nearly the end of our story. Because the key question was, how had Fuller committed two acts of brutal murder and rape 5 months apart in 1987 and then suddenly just stopped? Well, the answer would soon become horrifyingly clear.
As police searched David Fuller's home, they discovered a box screwed into the back of a wardrobe in his study.
Bad news. Bad news bears, red flag, klaxons going off, danger, danger, high voltage, death, don't enter. Bad news.
Yeah. I was doing an application for home insurance the other day. This is so boring. I promise it has a point. One of the questions was like, do you have a lockable safe in your house?
Oh.
I was like, why would I?
Not a fucking Bond villain.
I know. Bizarre. Anyway, the box, the secret box in the back of the wardrobe, contained portable hard drives. So he understands a portable hard drive, but he doesn't understand that you shouldn't post-it note your PIN number to your card.
No.
Overall, investigators found nearly 100 hard drives on David Fuller's property, containing 4 million images and 1 million videos. Some of these videos and images were clearly downloaded off the internet, and they were extremely violent pornography, which I'm sure wouldn't surprise you, but there were also thousands of images and videos of children, including a video of a 6-year-old being vaginally raped, a 3-year-old orally raped, and a 5-year-old girl being masturbated over. He's got kids.
3. The youngest one was still just a teenager.
Stomach churning stuff. And the police realised to their horror as they worked through the endless files. What a job, my God.
It's horrific. I watched the documentary that is on Now TV, and they interview the lead officer who was responsible with going through all of the evidence. And he was like, I don't want to let anybody else look at this. So he took the bulk of it on for himself. And he is like, he strikes you as a very like no-nonsense guy. He's like an older guy. He's clearly been in the police a long time. He's been around the block. And he was like, I had to tell my wife everything, even though I knew it was wrong, because I had to explain why I was going home every night sitting on the stairs and crying.
Oh my God. And that poor man realised, sifting through all of these horrible, horrible things, that what they had found in David Fuller's house was the biggest stash of child abuse images and videos ever discovered in this country. But still, that wasn't everything.
All this content had, it looked like, been sent to Fuller, or like he'd perhaps found it on the dark web. There are statements made later when it comes to the court case that they suspected that he had also produced some of these child sex abuse images and videos, but they never sort of like really talk about it again when it comes to sentencing. So I don't know. I think they just couldn't prove that he'd produced it, but they highly suspected.
Well, that's a dark web thing, isn't it? To gain access into these forums where you can download all of these things, you have to sort of do your own token.
Yeah, I show something. And, you know, not everybody who's on the dark web consuming this kind of content is a producer, because they may not have access to children, as horrific as that is. But it was strongly suspected that Fuller had produced some of this. But I think because he admits to all of it, and they find everything else later, it just looks like they didn't have enough evidence to pursue that. But it was very clear that there were images and videos that Fuller had produced himself. The difference was, however, that all of the victims in Fuller's own work were dead. In a morgue, dead. Yes, that's right, because Fuller has two monikers. The Bedsit Killer, and also the monster in the morgue. There were folders saved on his hard drive with the names Necro Lord, Deadly, Deadliest, and Best Yet. And we'll get back to what these videos and images actually showed a little bit later. They're in my brain, and so I'm sorry, you're not going to get let off the hook. You're going to have to hear all about it too. And I'm sure you can already start to make some pretty good guesses as to what they contain. And warning, it's pretty fucking rough. But first, we need to rewind all the way back to 1988.
And we have to do that because it was in November 1988, a year after the murders of Caroline and Wendy, that Fuller got a job as an electrical maintenance contractor at Kent and Sussex Hospital. Soon after he was hired, he was promoted to supervisor. And he worked at that hospital until May 2011, at which point he moved over to be estates manager at the new Pemberley Hospital in Tunbridge Wells. At Pemberley, he was responsible for all of the maintenance and upkeep of the hospital and the grounds. His swipe card gave him unfettered access to the entire building, including the mortuary.
Fuller worked very conveniently for his horrific extracurricular activities on a different time schedule to the pathologists and morgue workers. He'd start his shift after they'd all gone home, and then would easily slip down into the morgue, claiming that the fridges needed seeing to on a weekly basis. And so, at night, all alone down in the morgue, knowing that no one would disturb him, Fuller got to indulge in his worst impulses. He took a camera down with him and would fastidiously record himself abusing the corpses. He would take his time, strip himself off completely, then remove his chosen body for the night out of the fridge and unzip it from the body bag, before laying it on the floor of the morgue or sometimes sitting it in a chair, and then he would place himself astride it. And I haven't seen these videos, thank fuck, but I have read very, very detailed accounts of what officers witnessed in them. And in one of them, apparently, he breaks the nose of a woman's body because he is so violently assaulting the corpse. And Fuller's videos show him doing all sorts of horrific things, penetrating the bodies with his penis, his fingers, and even his tongue. He can clearly be seen in the footage putting his penis in the mouths, vaginas, and anuses of these cadavers. He sucks the breasts of some of the bodies and masturbates as he touches them. There's no other word I can think to describe it other than ghoulish. Especially because the officers that watched the footage say that he's almost always just in total silence with no expression or emotion on his face. It makes me shudder. It's horrific.
Some of the bodies that Fuller assaulted had been in accidents. Some had had post-mortems and been sewn back up. Some had medical equipment still attached to them.
Oh.
In one of his videos, it looks as if Fuller attaches an electrical impulse machine to a body and then to his own genitals during the assault. He's never in a rush because he knew he wouldn't be disturbed. But still, it is quite an enormous risk, and he seems to have no fear at all. In the documentary that Saru mentioned, Monster in the Morgue, one of the detectives explains how one night when Fuller was about to get started, there was a noise off camera. Fuller, totally naked, bar a pair of socks, looks shocked for a moment, then quickly turns the light off. The detective said he expected that when the lights came back on, Fuller would be dressed. But he wasn't. He just waited long enough to check. No one was there. And then he got straight back to what he was doing. Nothing was going to stop him.
That image in particular is just so horrific, because imagine, he's in there, completely naked, probably with a body out. There's a noise of somebody coming. He turns the lights out. Imagine if that person had walked into the morgue and turned the lights on and seen David Fuller with a body completely naked. I mean, what? And he's willing to take these risks to get what he wants.
The last incident of abuse that was recorded by Fuller took place on the 30th of November 2020. I'm going to say that again, so you all understand what I'm saying. The final incident of abuse that was recorded by Fuller took place on the 30th of November 2020. Just days before he was arrested for the murders of Wendy and Caroline from 1987. So despite his age, Fuller wasn't slowing down, and if he hadn't been arrested, you're damn sure he would have kept going.
3 days before. He's arrested on the 3rd of December. So what of Fuller's psychology? To understand that, let's talk about necrophilia.
Yay!
The word itself comes from the words necros, meaning corpse, and philia, meaning love or affinity for. But it doesn't always mean someone who wants to fuck dead bodies. It's essentially a term used to refer to any kind of sexual arousal coming from death.
I didn't know that. That's very interesting.
Nor did I. So it's probably more accurate to call necrophilia a death fetish. And looking into it, I've watched a lot of videos, I've read a lot of articles about it, I've read a lot of comments left by internet users about it. And there are a lot of people out there who are like, I have this. And look, at a fantasy level, sure, go nuts, do whatever you want. I'm not going to pretend like I would be cool with it, but like, you do what you want to do. But moving to act on it requires an absolute lack of empathy. I've joked before on this show that necrophilia is a victimless crime, but it will become incredibly clear in this episode that David Fuller's actions had a harrowing and profound impact on hundreds of people who knew and loved his victims. And while the people whose bodies he abused may have shuffled off their mortal coils, there is something undeniably depraved about using the remains of another human being as a masturbatory tool.
The problem with trying to understand necrophilia is that it's just not that well researched, because it's gross and we don't want to look at it. And it's also rare, so there's not a huge sample size to draw from. And often, those people who commit it don't want to talk about it either. Unless their fucking Dennis Nilsen can shut that man up. And it's also massively underreported. Is that the right word? Unreported, unidentified, undiscussed, unobserved?
Yeah, I didn't know what the right word was. It's like, the victim is very silent, so who's going to report it? Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's not like they're choosing not to come forward. Who knows how often this happens? Oh, it's just so impossible to tell.
But Saru diligently has trawled through lots of papers that are out there on necrophilia, And a key question that comes up again and again in the literature is this. Is necrophilia always because of sexual attraction? Some people claim that it's actually to do with power. And we can buy that when it comes to the killer who kills someone and then spontaneously abuses the corpse afterwards. Power makes sense in that setting. It can be to do with power, possession, and wanting to own their victim totally. But Fuller was clearly, looking at the videos he made, absolutely sexually getting off on what he was doing. So where does the sex end and the power begin? It's both, unsurprisingly, sex and power.
Some researchers distinguish between necrophilic homicide and what they call quote-unquote regular necrophilia.
Can you imagine? Like, I also think this is an element of why there's so little research out there. If you're a fucking PhD student and you're just in the pub and they're like, oh, what are you doing your thesis on? And you're like,
It's a lot, isn't it? So yeah, they distinguish between these two things. There's also necrophilic fantasies, but that's not really important to this. That refers more to people who just get off thinking about it, which, like I said, like, sure, fine, do what you need to do. But here we're talking about these two. Now, necrophilic homicide is obvious, does what it says on the tin, and it is somebody like Jeffrey Dahmer, right? He was a product killer. The kill itself wasn't what did it for him. It was a means to an end. He didn't enjoy the kill per se. Dahmer would often actually get hammered before he killed his victims. What he wanted was the dead body or, you know, in his world, a sex zombie. And he wanted that after the kill to play around with. To have someone he wouldn't have to try connect with, someone who wouldn't leave him. Someone he could own, I guess.
And regular necrophilia is more to do with those people who find themselves jobs that give them access to dead bodies that they can abuse. Regular necrophiliacs want a lifeless, non-threatening, unresisting partner. And that seems to often be their aim or desire, usually stemming from some sort of intimacy issue or social anxiety. But they may well also have a specific sexual attraction to something, like, for example, how decomposition feels.
Oh, when I read that, I was like, no.
Yeah. And again, it's hard to know because of the lack of research, because nobody wants to read this shit.
But we did find the idea that Fuller was purely motivated by the desire for an unresisting partner. Hard to buy.
Yeah, man, I don't buy that at all.
No. Because we know that he killed at least two women in brutal, super high-risk attacks in their own homes. I think it's safe to say that Fuller enjoyed abusing the bodies of dead women. Even with Caroline and Wendy, the sexual assaults were post-mortem. But I think Fuller was perfectly happy to kill to get what he wanted. If you wanted an unresisting partner, you would just first and foremost get the job at the morgue. You wouldn't have gone through the effort, even if you didn't get off on the kill, to kill. They are very resisting at that point. I think he stopped the murders because of self-preservation.
100%.
He had been breaking into people's homes, stalking them, carrying out acts of voyeurism from his early days. Then he escalated to murder. And he killed both Caroline and Wendy in 1987. And he left his semen at the scene.
Yeah, I think, like, it's because they connect the two deaths. And he's like, oh, shit, man.
Yeah.
This could go badly for me.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes me so angry is knowing how pleased he would have been with himself the day he realised he could just get a job in a morgue.
100%. I think you're totally right that he was like, it's getting a little bit hairy. And he's an intelligent man. And I think he was able to think about the consequences of what would happen if he got caught. So he realizes that they link the murders. He realizes that he's left a semen at the scene. And this leads me to my key reason why I think he stopped when he stopped. Because, Hannah, what else happened in 1988?
What happened in 1988?
This is a very hard question I'm just throwing on you.
Something to do with DNA evidence?
Yes. Colin Pitchfork.
I was going to say Colin Pitchfork.
Colin Pitchfork was convicted in 1988. In early 1988. And he kills Caroline. In late 1987, he's left his semen there. Colin Pitchfork, for those of you who don't know, who haven't listened to our episode on that, was the first murderer ever to be convicted using DNA evidence. And I think David Fuller saw that. And I think he was like, I got to stop this.
Absolutely. Calm, assured and under control. He knew that if he kept going, he was going to get caught. So he got himself a job where he could get his hands on all of the dead bodies he wanted. And he got away with it for 12 years. So, yeah, we don't really buy that David Fuller had an issue with murdering his victims. He just stopped killing when he started getting his fix elsewhere, more conveniently.
So coming back to what the police found at Fuller's home, it took 9 officers 5 months to work through all the evidence. Because not only was it the largest stash of child sexual abuse images that had ever been found in this country, it was now also the largest stash of necrophilia ever found. In total, Fuller had filmed himself abusing 102 corpses. The youngest was just 9 years old. The oldest was over 100. This is a clip from Fuller being interviewed by the police about what they had discovered at his home.
I want to admit that I am admitting the offences, but I don't really want to go into detail.
Yeah. Okay.
I do appreciate that.
And what offences are you admitting, David?
As you've just described to me.
Okay. In terms of the sexual penetration of
yes.
corpses? Okay. And do you know how many occasions, David?
No.
The second part to this, David, is the recording, isn't it? Of what's been happening. Okay? And we'll have to go through that in a little bit more detail, but just for now, David, all right? Just for now, all right? When that's been happening, okay? Have you been recording yourself doing those things? Sexually penetrating the corpses?
Bit bad,
Hank says. Yeah? Okay. What did you retain the recordings for?
I don't know either.
Okay. Was it for further sexual pleasure, David? In the same way as somebody would keep pornography or things like that? Was it for further sexual pleasure?
No.
Okay. David, this is probably the hardest question, all right? Well, the hardest one for you to answer. I want you to try and feel comfortable answering it. Why did you record what was going on?
I don't know why.
I don't know, David, whether certain things in your life have given you the opportunity to do it. Can you see where I'm coming from? It could be a particular shift. It could be a particular day when the mortuary closes early. It could be something else in your personal life that allows you to do that. Or there may not be a sequence. It might just be when one of the females enters the mortuary. What was your thought process about your offending, David? How do you decide that offence would occur? I mean, you know, is it?
It didn't have a particular...
It was a mammoth task for investigators to identify the victims. They had to watch every video, frame by frame, to look and see if they could read the names of the bodies on their hospital wristbands. They were also looking for things like scars, tattoos, anything they could use to help them identify who the victims were. And in the end, officers would identify 91 of the 102 victims. And then there was a big discussion with the hospital and the ethics team about whether to tell the families or not. And I've had a lot of conversations with people over the last couple of weeks while I've been researching this case. People not connected to Red Handed just being like, oh my God, David Fuller. And when I get to this part of the story, everyone is like, I wouldn't want to know. Mm. Why would I want to know? Don't tell me. But of course they had to tell the families. Fuller would be charged and the hospital would be named. And then you would have a situation where thousands of families would then be clamoring for answers. And if they had covered it up, it would look like a cover-up. It would look like a scandal. They had to tell them, even though it is absolutely heartbreaking.
The names of the victims have never been released publicly, which, you know, quite right. But the documentary on this case is on Now TV. And in that, they do speak to some of the families. There were endless accounts from devastated family members. But the two that really stuck with us were that of a woman in her 40s who died of cancer and the horror for her grieving children upon finding out what had happened to their mum and how it tainted for them every memory of her.
The thing that they say that I completely understand is that they were told what had happened, right? But they're obviously never shown the images or the photos or the stills or anything like that. The police are like, we've identified it. It's your mother. And they're like, every time I close my eyes, all I see, all I imagine is what he did to my mother. And this idea that after your loved one passes away, there's so much trauma, there's so much grief. You leave them in a hospital, you think that they're safe. And you're getting on with the next stages, planning the funeral, etc. And you never expect that something like this is going to happen, and then you find out, and it's just being re-traumatized all over again. And the fact that they can't get their imaginations to stop conjuring up horrific images of what happened. It's just torture. What other word is there for it?
There's also one woman whose husband and two daughters were killed in a car accident. She was also in the accident, but she survived and had to wake up to a world in which she'd lost everything, only to then be told that Fuller had abused the corpses of her dead children.
Why? That one is the one that pushed me over the edge with this case. Just how do you cope with that information?
You can't. It's unfathomable. There's no support group. It's bizarre and humiliating.
Yeah, there's no like, oh, my child was a victim of a necrophilic fucking electrician at the hospital. Let me find other people who have gone through the same thing and talk my way out of this. Like, it's so fucking... If we think necrophilia is unspoken about, it's unresearched, it's so, like, little understood. The people who are touched by this crime, because in this country it is a crime, where the fuck do they go for support?
Most of the victims said that they never told anyone outside immediate family members what had happened. And the mum, who'd lost her husband and two kids, was so broken by what she was told, she turned up at the police station where Fuller was arrested with a knife to kill him. She was arrested for her own safety, and the arresting officer said that she cried as she arrested the woman when she found out why she was there.
Now, you might be wondering, how did Fuller get away with what he was doing for so long? He was doing it for 12 years. Well, at the hospital, there was no CCTV down in the morgues. And this was ironically to preserve the dignity of the dead.
Was it you who told me that when morticians, or what is the word, coroners, do post-mortems on children, they talk to them?
Oh, no.
So I can't remember where I read about this, heard it, blah, blah, blah. Let's face it, probably on TikTok. No, I don't think that's true. I think I read an article about how, because it's the dignity of the dead, and like when it's children, there's this like tradition within the profession of like explaining to them what you're doing because they won't understand.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, I get it. Doing a job like that, you've got to find some way to cope, especially when you're looking at a child in front of you. So yeah, there was no CCTV, there was no way. I'm not going to say there was no way anyone could have caught him, but he just wasn't caught because of that. There was a like public inquiry into this after it all came out and he was charged, but like, you know, okay. But it didn't matter that there was no CCTV because with all his own homemade videos, the police had everything they needed. And Fuller, although he kept denying having killed Caroline and Wendy, admitted to the morgue activity. and also, obviously, to being in possession of all of the vast amounts of child sex abuse images that he had at his house. And the charges that were laid against Fuller were 33 of sexual penetration of a corpse, one charge of voyeurism, and a variety of offences concerning the taking, making, or possession of indecent images of children, and extreme pornographic images. Just to be clear, I did say this earlier, but abusing a corpse isn't actually a crime in all countries, but it is here in the UK. Under Section 70 of the Sexual Offences Act 2003, it is an offence for a person to intentionally penetrate any part of the body of a dead person with his penis or any other body part, for example, a finger, or any other object where the penetration is sexual. And perhaps that's why David Fuller said that yes, he had done everything he was accused of with the corpses. After all, they had the video, so it's not like he could deny it. But he made it very clear, and you would have heard it in the interview clip we played earlier. He said he hadn't done it for sexual gratification. Which, like, okay.
No one believed him. And so, David Fuller was charged with the abuse of 102 corpses. But sentencing would have to wait until after the trial for the 1987 murders. This one kicked off on the 1st of November 2021 in Maidstone Crown Court. Fuller was charged with the murders of Wendy Nell and Caroline Pierce. But still, denied everything. Until, that is, the fourth day of the trial, when the prosecution's forensic expert took the stand to explain the DNA evidence. And only just now figuring out that the jig was absolutely up.
I'm sure he took one look at the jury's face while the prosecution were presenting this evidence and he was like,
He stopped the trial and he changed his plea to a guilty one. Upon the conclusion of this trial, David Fuller was sentenced to 12 years for the abuse of the bodies in the morgue, and then the judge handed down a whole of life order without the possibility of parole for the murders of Caroline and Wendy.
Whole of life orders are not that common in the UK. But Justice Chima Grubb said that her decision was based on, quote, the location, the repetition, the abuse of position, the utter degradation of those recently living human beings, and in particular, the multiplicity of Fuller's victims. Finishing off with, quote, there is no mitigation. I have seen no evidence of genuine remorse as opposed to hollow regret now that you are under public scrutiny.
Chima Grubb, I think you should write a novel.
She is pretty good. She is pretty good with her words. And I think she gets him. She gets what Fuller is about because his entire demeanour in court, his entire demeanour in the police interviews, he's not an actually calm, zen person as he presents himself because they've seen the fucking videos of him assaulting corpses until he broke one of their noses. And he violently murdered two women in 1987. But he's very concerned with how other people perceive him. He's very, very concerned with that. And that's why you hear in the clip we played earlier, he's like, oh, no, I don't want to talk about it. I'm sure you can appreciate why. And it's like, why? Because you don't want everybody to know what a nasty, disgusting little piece of shit you are. Hyper concerned with that. But there's no genuine remorse behind it. There's no like, I'm sick. I couldn't stop myself. I knew it was wrong to kill. And that's why I got this job in the morgue and I was doing like, not that that would have been acceptable, but there's nothing like that. He knew what he was doing and he was fucking loving it. In all the videos that they find, he's labelled each one with the victims' names when he knows them. He's put their ages, he's put descriptions of them. Like, he was pathological. This was everything to him.
And when it came to the victims, Judge Chima Grubb had this to say, focusing on the accomplishments of the women and girls that Fuller had abused. One had flown across the Atlantic in a propeller-driven airplane via Iceland alone. Another was a talented skier. One had worked at Bletchley Park during World War II. Many had long and happy marriages. A number had worked hard in professions such as teaching or in the NHS, caring for others and looking after the interests of their students, clients and patients. All had families that they nurtured and loved. Some spent the last part of their lives in suffering, whether through disease or old age. But they didn't lose their dignity until you decided to take it from them. And of course, Your victims are not all among the dead. They fill this courtroom.
Yeah, and I think that was a particularly moving part of the judge's statements, because she can't name the victim. She can't name any of the women and girls who were abused in the morgue. So I think it was nice to pay a tribute to who they were. And yeah, it's just fucking horrible, really. And it gets worse, because there was a victim impact statement read to the court by the mother of the 9-year-old girl that Fuller had abused. And she said this: "You raped my baby." She couldn't say no to a dirty 66-year-old man who was abusing her body. She couldn't say no, but she would have. There's no closure. How can I make this up to her? How can I nurse that little broken body that's been ruined and disrespected by that vile man? I will never be able to get over this.
The question that remains at the end of this case, however, is that Fuller killed two women in 1987, and then there's a 20-year gap. He picks up in 2008 and abuses corpses until he was caught in 2020. What was he doing in those two decades in between? To be honest, I don't really want to think about it, and we probably will never know. David Fuller is a man who is sexually depraved, and even at the age of 66, he was never sexually satisfied. He was down in that morgue weekly, raping dead bodies, and he only stopped because they caught him.
And we also know that he was very skilled at living a deceptive and double life. His colleagues at the hospital saw him as a nice, polite, thoughtful man who would help them out with a squeaky door or a busted light bulb with a smile on his face. No one had a clue what he was up to behind closed doors. In fact, the day before Wendy's murder, Fuller had done a group bike ride from London to Brighton. And then the day after the murder, he'd taken his car to be serviced. So yeah, just bike ride, murder, car service. It was all just part of his life. Fuller was completely at ease with his depraved life. And he was a master at hiding in plain sight, making him the most dangerous kind of monster. And that's why we'll never know what he did in those two decades in between. So yeah, horrifying stuff. I hope everyone's feeling okay. I'm not.
Why do we do this again?
I don't know.
Horrific.
I'm just glad it's over.
Yes, me too. Get a dog. Sleep with it in your bed. Is my advice.
Good advice. Be safe. And this is just the start, guys. We've got a whole month of this shit. So we will see you next week for another October Terrifier. Goodbye.
Bye.